Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart.
And I'm Gary Bain.
And together, we're Pete and Gary's Military History
Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the podcast. Good morning, good morning. We've danced the whole night through. Good morning.
We've
good
stanced morning. The whole night
through. We've stanced.
I'm taking this stance all night.
I love taking a stance. Anyway, hello, Gary. I'm Peter Hart. You're Gary. I seem to have got the wrong teeth in again today. So I like a good start to a podcast, he said. So Gary, you'd better say what we're doing, as I can't seem to speak at all.
Well, today, Pete, we're continuing in the series of podcasts surrounding the Somme. And as we said previously, we're not going to concentrate just on the 1st of July. We're actually going to do a series that runs right the way through. So people might be asking, well, why are you doing something now then? Well, we're going to do Somme preparations 1916 today, Pete.
And that follows on, and on the planning one that we did, which went through the whole planning process and how they got to where they were. Sounds a good idea to me. I hope we've got some notes.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I was thinking about when you suggested we do this is just have a think about the sorts of things that you and I need in our everyday lives just to get through the day.
Beer,
clothes, sometimes. More beer. That's about it, really, isn't it?
Beer and clothes,
that's us sorted. But just have a think about it.
Oh, salted peanuts.
You know, rations, healthcare, dentistry, all the things you're going to need, and then multiply that by hundreds of thousands for the men on the Western Front.
It's going to be a big job. And actually, you've led us into where we're going to start, because people think when planning a battle, they often leave logistics till last when they're talking about it. Well, we're not doing that. We're going to start with logistics. We have been influenced by Rob Thompson, the guru.
Rob Thompson, the guru.
Yeah. Gorgeous sex god.
He is. But yeah, I mean, he puts logistics front and centre, doesn't he?
He does. Every time. But do you know, modern warfare, 1916, it's just bloody impossible without a thorough grasp of the theory and practice of the science, if you like, of logistics.
Not the geography of logistics.
I wouldn't know. Geography's not my strong point. it's not something you start in June for an offensive in July, is it? The 1st of July. So early in 1916, you've got the headquarters staff of 4th Army and the whole of the BEF, but 4th Army, though, they've got the awesome task of deploying some 400,000 men, well over 1,000 guns, 100,000 horses, yay!
Some of whom have got their own teeth.
this has all got to be put forward. And this battle, the Battle of the Somme, is right at the centre of the Allied plans. It's not just on the Western Front. It's also coordinated with offences on the Russian Front, on the Italian Front, and everywhere you can think of.
So what's the Somme area like? Is it like a big concreted area that's ideal for a gathering of logistics?
No, it's basically next to the French, and I think that's the only thing that Joffre, the French commander-in-chief, had in mind. We did discuss that, but it's agricultural by nature. It still is, really, isn't it?
It is. In
1916, it had almost no modern road and rail network. There's no infrastructure at all for this kind of deployment. And it's a bloody nightmare for the logistical planners. They've got to, you know, before they can start, they've almost got to create an infrastructure from scratch. And you worked in the railway systems, the Transport for London. And well, what do you think of the rail system that existed? What sort of problems exist in the railway network that linking Albert, that's the deployment point, if you like, to the rest of the very good rail system in France? What about that bit of it?
Well, the obvious thing is only freight trains had anything like the physical capability to move the quantities, huge quantities, that were required for an offensive, given the timescales, Pete. So...
So what are we talking about? How many?
Well, the staff officers, they calculated that every single day, the 4th Army would need 14 trains to carry ammunition.
So that's bangy things.
Yeah. A further 11 trains for supplies. Now, that could be anything. Yep. You know, that could be rations through uniforms, anything. And 6 trains to carry the reinforcements, horses and general stores. Now, this meant that in all, some 31 trains per day were needed just to service the 4th Army.
Now, what about when the actual offensive starts? So, how much? Well,
they reckon that would increase to about 70 trains.
So, we need just over 30 trains a day, and when the offensive starts, we need 70. So, tell me about the two railway lines.
And let's not forget, Pete, not only are you taking things up, once the offensive begins, you've got the wounded, you've got to get them away. So it's an incredible logistical problem that they're battling with.
So what are the railways like? What are they, sir?
Well, there were only two lines that served the Albert area, and one of these was... inconveniently, a non-standard gauge, typically helpful. So it's obvious that something drastic would have to be done.
So what was done? And what is the scale of what they're going to do? You worked in contracts, so they decide to... Well, I'll set it up for you. They decide to construct 2 new standard gauge lines, and with the associated railheads for the battlefront, that they're also going to provide rail spurs and loads of sidings to service the various ammunition and supply depots. Well, expand the stations and the rest of it. Now, how big a job, from your experience at TfL, is this? How much work would it be to put a new, say, southern line in to service Bromley with all the associated spurs, depots and everything else? Would you be able to do that in 4 or 5 months?
I hate spurs. I'm going to answer that with one word. Crossrail. How late is Crossrail?
Don't know.
How much is the overrun on cost?
Aren't you responsible for Crossrail?
No, I wasn't. So it's, you know, it's not easy, even with today's modern equipment, with... you know, complete access to the railway. And then let's not forget, once you've done it, you've got to maintain it.
So this is to do it in what, 6 months?
It's incredible.
In fact, it's got to be done in much shorter time than that. It's a huge, massive undertaking. Now, even that's not the full scope, because they're going to put in light railway system. Deckerville, but I believe there are others. For people who don't know what a Deckerville railway is, if you used to go on a children's railway when you were young, they were often First World War Deckerville tracks. I think it's not the case now.
Yeah, well, the idea with those is to get as close to the front as you possibly can. Now, they didn't go all the way to the front, but they got you as close as possible.
So they go from the railheads for the big railway to as far as close as they could get.
Yeah.
Yeah. So a huge amount of work to be done on the railway system. What about the roads? What state were they in, do you think?
Well, there were a few metal roads, which we would refer to as main roads, I suppose. But they weren't constructed to a sufficiently stringent standard, and they began to break up. I mean, the level of traffic that they were having to cope with.
Now, what sort of problem are we talking? Is this things like the big guns, heavy artillery, or just the wagon? It's just anything.
It's just anything. And even troops, you know, marching up and down these roads. The roads were not designed for the level of traffic that they were taking. Now
that's the main roads.
That's the main roads. The side roads, they're basically little more than rough tracks. And they became so muddy that they were all but indistinguishable from the fields.
Ooh.
You didn't think I could say the word indistinguishable, did you?
I thought you could say it. I was a bit worried about stringent.
Or fields.
They've got to improve and widen the roads from the railhead. What about bridges? I mean, are bridges in a rural area built to withstand the sort of weight of a sort of massive, great, bangy thing?
No. So you've got to strengthen the bridges. You've got to identify all of this as well, Pete. That's part of the logistics. You can't just, you know, have somebody turn up and say, oh, God, we should have done this bridge. So you've got to do this well in advance. You've got to have a widespread program of road construction.
And there's a problem there. What's the problem with a widespread program of road construction? If you think about it, what is the problem?
Well, how are you going to get the material forward that you need to do the roads? Well, you're going to use a railway. So that's putting an increased burden on the railway. And they're already struggling.
Because the roads need enormous amounts of raw materials, stone, basically, foundations, and then all the tarmac at them and everything else, you know. So, in fact, what happens is they settle for patchwork repairs. When the road surface collapsed, they repaired it. So it's basically like modern roads in this country. They're just patched until someone actually complains who's got some authority. What about behind the line? How did the small... I mean, it's dotted with small villages, farms, you know, the occasional small town, isn't it? How they'd struggle, wouldn't they, in peacetime to billet the sort of army units coming into the area. How do you think they cope with nigh on 500,000 men?
Well, they get swamped and, you know, you get bivouacs, tents and huts. They're the obvious answer. And you get these huge imposing camps that were soon erected all around the villages and woods. So the villages effectively became military towns.
Now, you've got a quote from Sergeant Frank Ancham of the 97th Field Company, Royal Engineers. And this is quite interesting because it shows the sort of work that's going on just to set up the billets for the troops, never mind the roads and everything else. Come on then, Frank, tell me all about it.
The billets consisted of one large barn with a large and absolutely barren field. Within a fortnight, Major Philpotts had made comfortable beds of timber and wire netting for everyone, cookhouses and stables. At the lower end off the yard, he had improvised a bandsaw, two circular saws, a drilling machine, lathe and grindstone, all driven from one shaft by two 10-horsepower steam engines and a small petrol engine. And at very little cost, for practically all the machinery was salvaged from damaged French factories at Albert.
Stolen.
A party of men worked in the woods, which lie close to Ville in the Ancre marshes, cutting down suitable trees and lopping off branches. A pair of horses dragged the trees to the workshop, where another party of men barked them, and they were then lifted by the crane, another homemade patent of the Major's, up to the bandsaw. From there to the circular saws, cut to the required size and loaded straight onto the wagons, which were parked within a few feet and up the line the same night. Well, they were lucky to have Major Philpott from the sound of that.
Yeah, but it just shows how much work. That's just getting the wood for the billets and also the wood for the front line, of course, the need for revetting and things. It's a hell of a thing. Now, one big problem is water. Why is that a problem? Why could water be a problem? There's plenty of water in that area, surely.
Yeah, but the water supplies that were there, they were adequate for the existing population. So you start moving in hundreds and hundreds of thousands of men and they're soon overwhelmed by demand.
Because they're thirsty, aren't they?
Yeah, it's not only thirst. Thirsty men also need water to wash. And the thousands of horses, they seem to drink their own body weight in water on a regular basis.
You seem to drink your own body weight in beer.
I eat my own body weight.
All right, that's right.
But even lorries, you know, lorries have radiators. What do radiators need?
Oil.
Water.
I'm not very technical.
So there is a huge demand.
So what can they do about that? What sort of work are we talking? Well, they've got to dig new wells. But that then there's only so much, you know, an aquifer. And the French have got their eye on this. They're going, yeah. they've got to install pumping equipment. But again, that pumps out the water supplies. Miles of piping to get it to the right place. And then high-capacity water points, you know, as near as possible to the front lines. Where, of course, they can be disrupted by German shelling, I suppose. How would you basically sum this up?
Well, you're basically putting in a huge monumental effort trying to drag a rural French countryside in the Somme Valley into the 20th century.
Just ready to be smashed to bits.
Just in time to be smashed to pieces.
By opposing artillery of both sides. I like that idea. Now, even moving the infantry and guns up is a nightmare, isn't it? Now, this people think, oh, well, we'll move the such and such division up. But they take, each division takes so much of road. Each gun battery takes up so much of each, you know. So what are the problems on the road? Well, what do you have to do to the roads to get ready for this? Not well, just, I'm not talking about the surface now.
No. For one thing, you've got to assign roads for the move.
You've got to in, out.
You've got to have signposts erected. People, you know, have got to know where they're expected to be heading. You've got control posts established at major crossroads, and you had military police there trying to control the traffic because you've got hundreds of thousands of people. The roads were packed.
Absolutely packed, weren't they? And what sort of... So we've got... And this is where we mentioned they'll get churned up. Dirty, great big howitzers, aren't they? Churning up. Even a tarmac Adam road can be churned up. You can see this when a big lorry goes into a side street. They actually tear up the tarmac Adam. And a lot of it isn't tarmac Adam. It's, what you call it, pave. Big stony things, aren't they? Yeah.
Pave.
And what about traffic jams? You think they have traffic jams?
Well, of course they do. You've got tail-to-tail convoys of motor traffic. You've got horse transport. And a myriad variety. It's not... You know, just it could be anything. And, of course, you've got an endless column of infantry.
Dum, drum, dum, rum, rum, dum, dum, rum. Yeah. You're now going to be Lieutenant William Bluer of C Battery, 149th Brigade, Royal Field Artillery. He's quite a character, Bluer. What does he say?
The whole of the roads for the 5 miles I travelled were filled with artillery, infantry, motor lorries, ration carts, ammunition wagons, etc., in one unbroken line, going up to the lines full and being met by a similar continuous stream of empty vehicles returning, like Oliver Twist for more. Blocks were frequent, and it took me over 2 hours to get to Ettenheim. I estimated I saw not less than 3,000 vehicles, all with 6 horse teams. No Lord Mayor's show was in it at all.
It sounds good. I had a Lord Mayor show. Yes, didn't the Lord Mayor show always leave horse manure?
Possibly.
Especially with our current... Oh, no. Now, so delays, traffic jams, confusion. But you know what? Despite that, thanks to the work of a lot of people and everything, it works relatively smoothly, doesn't it? So that's part of the logistics stuff. Now let's talk about the preparations for the...
It's a good job it did, Pete, because otherwise they'd have to have called the whole thing off.
Yeah. Might have been good for the infantry we're going to look at now. People often seem to think that your job's done when you've recruited. You know, you've got K1, K2, K3, K4, K5. You've got all these hundreds of thousands of soldiers. Is that the end of the problem, recruiting them, do you reckon?
No, you've got to turn them into soldiers, Peter. They've got to be capable of meeting the relatively well-trained Germans in battle.
I tell you.
Now, it's not only that, is it? You're lacking variously officers, NCOs, uniforms.
Trained officers and NCOs. Yeah, yeah. This is what you mean, isn't it? You're lacking men with the experience
to train other men.
And to take command in extremely stressful situations.
It's not only that, you're missing kit, modern weapons. You know, you see pictures of them practicing drill in their civilian clothes carrying broomsticks. The most basic accommodation for the men. This is a desperate situation.
That's back in England. I should have made that clear when I was thinking. The accommodation at the front is a problem, but the accommodation back home in England where they're being trained is a huge problem.
Yeah.
And they're all over the place across England. And there's a shortage of experienced or skilled personnel of all kinds. So what do they do?
Well, they dig out, for want of a better word, a lot of old officers and NCOs, and they're called back to the colours to drill the ranks into some sort of semblance of discipline.
But surely if they're dug out, then they're not exactly up to date, are they? If they've been out of the army for 10, 15... Some of these are Boer War veterans, aren't they?
They are, and with these quickly amassed and ramshackle legions, the old British boast of the quality rather than quantity of their army, it's now starting to rebound against them.
Well, because this is they're going here for quantity, not quality, definitely. How do they contrast, you think, to, and not all, these are generalisations, to the bulk of the main force of the German army? How does our training compare with that?
Well, by comparison, our training is rushed. It lacks any depth or detail, and it's often irrelevant to the real needs of the troops in modern conditions of trench warfare.
Right. So when they've been trained back home, which is basic training and not in any way sophisticated, when they come out to the Western Front, they're attached to regular battalions serving in the line. So a battalion would come out and they'd be attached to a regular battalion.
Now, this was described as an easy introduction to the war. You know, this was designed to give them practical experience under a very close supervision in the often strange routines.
And, well, they are, aren't they?
And lurking dangers of trench
life. You can't put your head up and have a look.
No.
You can.
And some did and some died.
Yeah. There's lots of dangers, lots of things you have to learn. So then, you know, having come in, they'd then serve, probably as a whole division, would move into a quiet area, and it would be responsible for a quiet area. Things like Plug Street, which had been murder, but now were quiet areas. You often hear Plug Street mentioned as a first area. For most of them, though, the Somme, the upcoming Somme battle, that's going to be their first baptism of fire, isn't it? The first real, I mean, they've been in the line. This is going to be the first time they're in a real scrap, isn't it?
It is, and the training that they require, it never really finishes, Pete. That when they're out of the line after a couple of days' rest, all units would resume a programme of individual training. Now, that was designed to reinforce the basic military skills and to prepare them for the imminent offensive.
Now, we discussed this earlier when we talked about the planning. Haig didn't want to go into action until August at the earliest because he felt his armies weren't trained. But they were doing their best to catch up, to try and get the men trained. But the Somme, the 1st of July, is very early, isn't it?
Yeah, but it was because the French required that support, and Joffre had put a lot of pressure on the British to commit to the earlier date.
So there we go. I mean, alliance warfare, isn't it?
It is.
Now, so the other thing is, it's not just training them in the basic weapons. There's new weapons coming. Now, I'll do the first one because it's the one that I really have come to become known throughout the world as for my expertise in it. And that's the Lewis gun. It's a light gun. It weighs about 26 pounds. And do you know what? The drums, each drum, Gary, would fire 47, had 47 rounds in. 47.
Well, I was led to believe, Pete, that it was between 41 and 47 on various occasions.
49 I've gone for in the past as well. No, 47 it is, and it has a range of about 2,000, an effective range of about 2,000 yards. What does it give to the infantry, do you think? What is its great
benefit? Well, it's a light
benefit.
Machine gun, and it gives the infantrymen a greatly increased firepower as they move forward. Now, that's something that they hadn't had previously.
So what we're saying here is, yeah, they're untrained and can't fire 15 rounds a minute, but bugger 15 rounds a minute when you've got a Lewis gun that's got a much faster rate of fire. So it's improving the overall firepower that you've got. But there's something else that's coming along, something else that massively increases the firepower available within an infantry or at the beck and call of an infantry battalion. What's that?
Well, the emergence of trench warfare, if you think about it, it led to a demand for a simple short-range mortar, and that's so that you could throw a shell upwards and across the short divide of no man's land.
And then it would fall.
It would fall, and hopefully it would fall on the trench opposite.
Now, there was none of these at the start. There were homemade various varieties, but one emerges that it's a three-inch mortar. That do you know what? I'm not sure you wouldn't have been trained on the three-inch mortar. Stokes mortar,
yeah, I think it was.
And it doesn't change much until the 70s. Stokes mortar, fantastic weapon. And it provides the infantry with, in a sense, their own artillery. But it's quite new at this time. It's coming in. There's another weapon that came at the end of 15 and was by then 16 in. What's that?
Well, you mentioned that there'd been improvisation up till this point. But another important weapon that they had to master was the hand grenade, as we would recognise it. And by 1916, the army had settled on the mass-produced Mills bomb, which was a reliable fragmentation grenade.
Not necessarily the best, but it was the one that they could manufacture. It's the one they chose. And they had to train everybody in that. Something else that they have to learn, the troops have to learn, and this is they have to learn how to defend themselves against it, and that's gas. Since the Second Battle of Ypres, it was obvious that they had to learn how to put their gas mask on. Now, that was which gas? Now, that's the pH gas mask, isn't it? That's the one that they all go through in the traditional British fashion.
Now, you've got to get that on properly, because if you don't, you die.
Ooh.
Simple as that.
The quick and the dead. Yeah.
Quick and the dead.
So they've all got all these skills to do, and what they've got the personal skills, but personal skills aren't enough. And this is where we really start to fall down. What else do you have to learn?
Well, you've got to learn a program of tactical exercises. You know, that's designed to try and get them ready for what's going to face them when they went over the top. Now, most men, they're keen to learn. They're recognising perhaps that they need all the help they could get. And you're going to do a quote from Brigadier General F.C. Stanley of HQ 89th Brigade.
Frederick Stanley, yeah. Lord Derby, I think he is. I'm not quite... Yeah, he is Lord Derby. This is what he said. We moved back for our training for the big push, full of enthusiasm, which carries one a long way. This training business was infinitely harder work than being in the line. There was no rest all day and far into the night for a good many of us. We dug, I suppose, from 6,000 to 7,000 yards of trenches. Of course, not to full depth, but enough to show what it looked like. Here we practised every day, getting every man to know exactly what was required of him and what the ground would look like on the day. They all tumbled to it very fairly well. He doesn't know what he's talking about. And certainly our practice improved all of us very much indeed. But there's there's something wrong with this, though. What is wrong with the training programme in 1916?
Well, it's in no way realistic, is it? There's no live firing from fixed line machine guns. There's no deafening explosive detonations to try to recreate the sheer shock and awe of war. Such training concepts just haven't been developed in 1916.
They hadn't. It's interesting for all the various people will boast. Oh, our country was the first to invent briefing on the battlefield thing. And you hear this going right the way through into 17. But they were already practicing and trying to train everybody on the ground. But you're right. Training on the ground, or, you know, similar things, learning your role, but without huge explosions, without people firing machine guns over you.
That's not to say that they weren't trying to do everything possible at the time.
At the time.
But you've mentioned it earlier, the chronic lack of experience meant to train the hundreds of thousands of raw youths.
They are raw as well, aren't they?
It meant that in reality, there was small chance of turning this vast conglomeration.
Well, yeah, a conglomeration of office workers, pitmen,
factory workers, farm labourers. You didn't mention bus or train drivers, I noticed.
Most of them were in reserved occupations, of course.
But you're trying to turn them into hard-bitten soldiers.
I'm not sure that's going to work so quickly. It takes longer. Overall, I think our view is that the Territorial and New Army divisions, they're promising material, aren't they? They're volunteers. They're all volunteers. But they haven't got the battle experience. They haven't experienced the sheer intensity of war. What about the regular divisions? They must have experienced the sheer intensity of war. Well, they must have done, mustn't they?
Yeah, well, they have. And by 1916, they're regular in name only. They too were filled with raw recruits, as the original ranks were for the most part either dead or still recovering from wounds, or indeed acting as instructors.
Yeah, they've been used to, which is probably what they should have been, actually, by the way. So these then are the infantry that are going to meet the German army on the the ridges and valleys of the Somme. Now, the tactical instructions for the infantry issued by 4th Army headquarters were quite controversial, and people will go, I've analysed the war diaries reason that, you know, well, for a start, war diaries aren't entirely accurate. What you say you're doing isn't necessarily what you're doing. But what is a basic program they've got? Well, they're going to advance at a steady walking pace in long lines of men, just 2 or 3 yards apart each, you know. This would ensure that relatively untrained troops wouldn't lose their alignment and would arrive at the German line at roughly, or exactly rather, the same time. The men in each line are 2 or 3 yards apart. The waves are about 100 yards or so separated. And if there was a sort of hold-up, they hoped that each wave would arrive and build up the weight of the assault to overcome whatever obstacle and get them back onto a sort of timetable. Now, this is not really how it works, either in theory or practice, and this is not a good thing to do. The first wave wasn't meant to mop up the German front line. It would keep going. The following waves would mop up and then push on behind the first wave. Later on, there was a leapfrogging thing, so the first wave... this is not great.
Now, let's not forget that the men are going to have to carry everything with them that they might need on the first 2 days to allow them to properly consolidate their imagined gains. Now, you know, as we'll come on to, this is a considerable undertaking in that the weight of all their kit and equipment, 66 pounds of weight.
And that's the least. That's if you're not given a pickaxe or a shovel or something else, a machine gun, Lewis gun drums or something to carry.
Yeah, and now that's inevitably going to restrict the mobility and speed of the men across any sort of unbroken ground. You can't run easily with that sort of weight.
You can't run at all, really. Now this is often, people don't understand, why do they take this, I think the clue is, why do they take this essential equipment across no man's land with them? Well, why, Gary? Why do they take essential equipment with them? Why?
Because it's essential, Pete.
So why couldn't they leave their rifle or some machine gun, Lewis gun drums? Why couldn't they leave their rations, their hard rations or their bombs behind? Why couldn't they leave the pickaxes behind?
Well, because you couldn't very well say to the very well-trained German army, could you just hang on a minute, I've got to nip back and get my pickaxe handle.
And people don't understand. And by the way, of course, we've learned a lot. We've learned. About how much was the weight carried by British infantry in the Second World War, indeed, now?
Well, it's a similar amount of weight.
In fact, if not more again, about 80. It comes. I mean, with extra equipment, which almost every infantry ends up carrying something extra, it's about 80 pounds. I don't think they call them pounds anymore.
No, I mean, the weight distribution's probably better in the modern army.
The First World War kit... The webbing was really well balanced. It's a lovely bit of kit. It may be better now, but it was as good as you can imagine then, and better than the Germans or the French kit. I've listened to Taff Gillingham. Oh, he knows, you know. He was there. So in essence, this restricts speed. Now, this is the whole thing is controversial because some people insist that the infantry just plodded across but actually that the Fourth Army tactical instructions that we've discussed, they're only a guidance and it's not what everybody did, is it? There are variations.
Yeah, they develop their own subtle variation, but for the most part, there's a fair degree of uniformity because all along the British line, because they have got the same, if you'll pardon the expression, raw recruits. More complex tactics of small columns, advanced infiltration patrols and the use of lightly equipped parties are meant to race ahead across no man's land to surprise the Germans right on the heels of the barrage were largely, but not entirely, absent.
So people are thinking, and some people are innovating, but for the most part, it is that the picture is not too sophisticated overall, is it?
No.
Now, there's another job for the infantry, another job that, do you know what? I think some soldiers might have moaned about.
No. I mean, they were working parties and they're all kept busy.
You're saying they didn't moan about
working? No, they would never moan. British soldiers never moan.
True. They never grumble either.
They never grumble. And working parties are kept busy in the front lines building headquarters dugouts to all the way through
trenches.
To assembly trenches for the attacking troops.
Attractive. Seeing as you're getting at me to...
For the attractive troops, The existing front line couldn't possibly contain all the men that would be needed so for the attack.
Do? What do they do? What do they do?
So they're having to dig extra trenches.
Assembly trenches.
Yeah, a series of extra trenches to shelter them before they go over the top.
Now, the next portion of it of we're going to talk about is not long, because we've got not a lot to say. But the one thing we want to say about it is important. So, cavalry. What do we want to say about cavalry? Why do we not criticise Haig for insisting that there is an option of a cavalry follow-up behind the infantry should they break through?
Well, what was the alternative? It's the only means that he has of rapid exploitation and pursuit in 1916. He's got no other way of doing it. So he's planning, if they are required, which, frankly, is entirely sensible, but it's led to a great deal of a comment from people that you have called in the past terminally stupid, Pete.
Bugger, I wanted you to say.
I know, that's why I said that you have.
Well, no, it's true, because people just don't understand. There is nothing else. There's no tanks. Tanks are slower moving than infantry.
3-4 mile per hour?
at best. There are no whippets, and whippets aren't much faster. Tanks are unreliable, they break down. There is no faster thing than the cavalry. So it's just an option. Option two, I would like to describe it as. So that's the that's all we're going to say about the cavalry. Obviously, but I would say, by having them behind the front, ready to be used, what does that mean that you have to get a lot of?
Get a lot of what?
A lot of fodder up. They do. We mentioned they eat their own weight in, and you eat your own weight, but horses.
I've often been called fodder.
Yeah, cannon fodder.
Oh, moving swiftly on, that's rather opportune. We're going to talk about artillery now, because books about the Somme have deliberately downplayed what we have both said on a number of occasions is the most important element of weaponry of the British Army. Now,
Now, I want to give you an example of this, and I'm not knocking the book, because I like it. I like the man who wrote it, although he's a miserable bugger. But then, Martin Middlebrook, he's a cracky bloke. Martin Middlebrook, First Day of the Somme, barely mentions artillery. Why is that, Gary?
Well, because it doesn't fit with this neo-romantic picture of helpless suffering amongst the victim infantry.
And that's not something we go along. We don't conceive of them as helpless victims.
No, the artillery lays at the centre of the Battle of the Somme, which was always destined to be a gunner's battle right from the start.
Yeah. Now, did they have the right tools for the task at hand? Well, let's go through them. I'll start the 18-pounder, the workhorse of the British artillery.
Now, that had come out of our experiences in the Boer War, hadn't
it, Pete? Right. They wanted a fairly mobile gun, but quick firing. And it's a reliable weapon. It's quick firing, as you said. Fires a shell. Guess how much a shell weighs from the 18-pounder?
15 pounds?
You idiot. Fool.
Or is it 18 pounds?
It's just over, apparently. I didn't know that, but apparently. What's its fault as a weapon?
Well, as I mentioned, it's come out of the experience of the Boer War, which was a war of movement. So it's got a limited range of around about 6,500 yards, although it could be raised to 7,800 yards by digging in the gun
tower. Does that mean it's got a range of 6,500 yards or behind the German front line?
No.
Why not? Don't we have the guns in our front line?
Well, no, that would be fairly silly, wouldn't it?
So they're 4,000 yards our side.
Yeah.
Which means what's the effective range?
Well, a couple of thousand yards at best.
At best. Which means, can it cover the German second line system?
No, it can't.
It can only cover the first line system. We discussed this, didn't we, in the planning, because that's the huge question of, do they try and get the second line as well? So what else have they got? Well, they've got the other field artillery gun that's worth mentioning. There are 15-pounders, but the one that really is worth mentioning is the 4.5-inch howitzer. Cracking gun. Is the shell 4.5-inch weight?
No, it's a 35-pound shell, which it fires up to 6,600 yards. Now, the point about the howitzer is that it's an entirely different looping trajectory. So that's up and then down.
Like a mortar.
Like a mortar.
So I'm getting that this also can only reach 2,000 yards behind the German line. At most, by the way, at most.
Yeah, because again, it's not in your front line trenches. That would not
be. So what about medium and heavy artillery?
Well, scarce in 1914.
Scarce as in almost non-existent.
Yeah, but there'd been a great expansion in the siege batteries of the Royal Garrison Artillery. Now, the weapons varied, but the key type amongst the guns was the 60-pounder gun, which held their shell up to 10,500 yards.
So that's seven, eight thousand yards behind, and that could reach the German second line system. Not second line system, yeah.
Yeah, and the bulk of the howitzers are a 6-inch or 9.2-inch type.
Yeah, we interviewed Montague Cleave, and he was with the Royal Garrison Artillery Battery, and that was very. Remember, that was way back. We did a podcast about him. Now, what were they firing, the artillery? Well, the field artillery often find shrapnel, aren't they? Well, what's shrapnel for?
Well, it's lethal if you catch the enemy infantry advancing across open ground. But it soon found that infantry in trenches are relatively safe from the effects of shrapnel. High explosive shells with direct action fuses, which exploded only on impact, were required to blast them out of their burrows. But these are initially in short supply.
Yeah, and they don't have the 106 fuse yet, which is an instantaneous explosion, which is a 1917 development. Again, you can't have something that hasn't been invented.
No.
So shrapnel shells. Now shrapnel can be part of a creeping barrage, but creeping barrel because that keeps your head down. I mean, if infantry are in the trenches firing at us, they'll get hit by shrapnel shells. But they're not really creeping barrages. Aren't really. We'll talk about that later. What are they mainly used for?
Well, they're mainly used now for cutting the barbed wire.
Now this,
that's not what they're designed to do.
But they had discovered in planning for Neuve Chapelle that was the most effective way of doing it because high explosive
just threw it up in the air and it came back down again, largely still as in one piece of barbed
so
wire.
So shrapnel for barbed wire cutting is not stupid.
The word I was struggling for there, Pete, was obstacle.
It's a difficult word for a young boy in his prime. So shrapnel shells, they're not stupid to use them that way, but it isn't that effective. One thing that's important is that you have to have a skilled gunner to get to time the fuse so that the shell explodes just above the barbed wire. Were the gunners of the massively increased and enlarged Royal Artillery all skillful?
Yes.
No, it would have been the correct answer. But yes, is another answer. I've been asked by the listeners to be more positive in my approach to Gary's blunders. So I'm sure you might have been right if you hadn't.
So how many guns have they got then, Pete?
Well.
Changing the subject swiftly.
I reckon we had about, I hate statistics, and I would say 1,500. 1,537 guns and howitzers. It works out, oh no, you'll have to work it out.
Well, it's one field gun to every 20 yards of front and one heavy gun to every 58 yards of front.
How does that compare to Neuve Chapelle?
Well, Neuve Chapelle was one every 6 yards, I think it was.
That's interesting. So this big bombardment, given that they have to cover more lines, we mentioned all this in the planning business, it's not that good. Now, the artillery plans, they're prepared by 4th Army and laid down the general tasks to be achieved by the guns under the subordinate corps, the control of the corps. So the corps, each corps would plan its own 6-day bombardment. You know, they're the ones. The corps and divisional commanders would sort out the barrage. What are the tasks of the guns? Just sum it up.
Well, to put it really simply, and this is an oversimplification, Peter.
Probably just as well.
The guns are there to clear away the German barbed wire defences, smash their lines of fortifications, and destroy the German artillery batteries.
Now, this is a problem because The German artillery are a severe threat, and actually they're the ones that really kill you in no man's land in Europe. Trenches before you go, all these things. So you need to make special arrangements for counter-battery fire. What's the problem with counter-battery fire when most of your guns are still field artillery?
Well, only the heavier guns and howitzers have got the long range that's necessary, as we mentioned earlier, to reach the German gun lines.
Because the German gun lines are 2,000 or 3,000 lines behind, which is more than we can reach. Yeah, that's a problem. So each corps allots a certain number of heavy and medium batteries to the task. However, what's the problem with this?
Well, unfortunately, amongst the many other priorities that fought for their attention, it's inevitable that sometimes there's simply not enough guns to go round.
There's just not an understanding at this time how crucial counter-battery fire is. And they've got other tasks to do. Batteries are double task, triple task, quadruple task, and they don't always prioritise in fact, they don't. The Royal Flying Corps may tell them where they are, the German batteries, but it may help them with artillery observation. But there's another problem. What's the other problem about hitting a German battery?
Well, it's got to be pinpoint accuracy, and as you mentioned, it's often beyond the raw gunners that we've got in 1916.
Now, what format is the barrage going to take?
Well, they're going to give much thought to the question of the manner of movement of the barrage line of exploding cells actually during the assault. So, in general, it was considered that this should sort of lift directly to the next German line of trenches when the British infantry emerged from their trenches and set off across no man's land.
So, this would mean that the moment you get out of your trench,
the barrage moves on.
So, moves off the German front lines.
Yeah, onto the next line.
And therefore the German defenders can come out and fire unbothered.
Unfettered! Yeah, they can. And just at the point that the infantry are slowly walking across no man's land.
So this is not a good idea. There is an emerging interest, which people always say, oh, well, Canadians invented, Australians invented, the French almost certainly invented the creeping barrage. But the British were to perfect it. Had they perfected it on the 1st of July, by the 1st of July 1916?
No, I mean, there's an emerging interest in the new theories introducing creeping barrage, which basically...
Can you explain it for me?
Yeah, the creeping barrage would start in no man's land, and it had moved up to and over the German front line, covering and carrying with it the attacking infantry. Now, they'd have to be really close behind. Now, this form of barrage had become the fulcrum of British attacks for the next 2 years. But so at that
the idea
point,
is there's a line of shells between the infantry moving forward, yeah, just in front of them, so that the Germans can't, that they're not, they are bothered, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, and you know, these are early days, and many of the gunners are worried about the daunting task of preparing and firing accurately such a barrage. The infantry themselves, they didn't really see the point, and certainly many divisional and brigade commanders didn't understand why the barrage had to start in front of the German lines.
And move forward. Funnily enough, I remember doing a documentary on the Somme, and the people, the film producers couldn't understand. They thought we'd got it wrong, that it would start on the German line. But that, no, starts and moves towards, i.e. threatening the infantry and forcing them to keep their head down, then over... And then just behind it come the infantry.
Yeah. Now, the end result of all this was that most corps commanders preferred to stick with what they knew.
So they don't use it. So they use this other barrage, which is clearly not right. Now, I want to make it clear. For instance, other countries carry on with this sort of approach. But the British abandon and move to the creeping barrage during the Somme later on. But these are early days, as we said before. So preliminary bombardment, that's going to be, six or seven days. Can't remember already.
Well, it's planned for 6 days.
That's right. And it gets extended. Of bad weather. And it builds to a crescendo. In the sort of lead up to 0 hour, and then it would lift and drop onto the next German trench, as you described. That's what, and there's some places, very few places. Now, the infantry, sometimes they'd have crept out into no man's land, wouldn't they? About 100 yards from the back of that barrage. This is not a creeping barrage, it's just a standard barrage. And then they'd move forward to take the German front line. This time, of course, our barrage is battering the next line, and then they gather again and move forward, and it would be a staged progress. It wouldn't be for long before they run out of range, would it?
No, and it's intended that the process would just be repeated over and over again several times in accordance with the timetable.
Seems optimistic to me.
Well, it doesn't allow for any hold-ups or any sort of general confusion of war. It's based on the belief expressed by both Haig and Rawlinson that the bombardment would sweep everything before it, and that the infantry would be faced with minimal opposition.
So they were wrong. And I have no problem with that. I have no problem with admitting that they were wrong about that. Now, the infantry are watching the guns coming forward. Now, this is their, they're pleased because this is what's going to make it easier, save their lives. Their survival depends on it. And this is a favourite of ours, Gary, Captain Charles May, 22nd Manchester Regiment. What does he say?
The face of the earth is changed up there, has changed within the last 7 days. It is now honeycombed with gun emplacements. Guns are everywhere. Guns of all calibres, some 9.2s were registering on Mametz whilst we were watching. They are terrible shells and simply knock lumps out of the village. There are 9.2s, 8-inch, 6-inch, 4.7s, 4.5s, 18-pounders and 13-pounders. All sorts and conditions, all bristling out of the ground, ready to belch forth a regular tornado of fire. As Worthy said when he saw it, "Fritz, you're for it." It's a sentiment I quite agree with. Ammunition is pouring up. That for the heavies by motor transport, that for the lighter fry by wagon and limber. Two convoys of the latter, each of them fully 500 yards in length, passed the Bois at sundown. It was a great sight. It is marvellous, this marshalling of power, this concentrated effort of our great nation put forward to the end of destroying our foe. The greatest battle in the world is on the eve of breaking. Please God it may terminate successfully for us. Fritz, I think, knows all about it. At any rate, a day or two, he put the following notice on his wire opposite the 4th Division. "When your bombardment starts, we are going to bugger off back 5 miles. Kitchener is buggered, Asquith is buggered, you're buggered, we're buggered. Let's all bugger off home."
So the Germans were posh British officers.
Yeah.
I absolutely love that quote.
Yes, I mean, it's brilliant.
Now, ammunition shortages, they've gone, haven't they? This is
largely the
Empire's put its shoulder to the wheel, if you like, and the figures are unbelievable. And remember, everyone has to be brought forward. So every 18-pounder gun's got 200 rounds a day for the 6 days of the bombardment. That works out at 1,200 rounds, Gary. I've been doing some maths remedial work recently.
How many for 6 guns?
6 times 1,200 is
7,200 rounds for a 6-gun battery.
I knew that. I was just joking.
Now, they all worked perfectly, of course, all these manufactured ammunition, yeah. Didn't they?
So lots more ammunition, but there's a diminution in quality. So they're not as good as previously, and some of them don't go bang. What is the point of an artillery shell?
To go bang.
So this is a problem. The percentage of duds, as they were called, could be very high. I'm not going to put a statistic on it. Let's just go with could be high. Now, 24th of June.
1, 2, 3 lots.
That's it. That's precisely it. So 24th of June, the great bombardment begins, Gary. Row, boom, boom, bang, boom, bang, a bang. And this is, who am I going to be?
You're going to be Captain Cuthbert Lawson of the 369th Battery, 15th Brigade, Royal Horse Artillery.
This always reminds me of the Spike Milligan joke. Armageddon on out of it! Armageddon started today, and we're right in the thick of it. I am now living in my damp hedge, he's a forward observation officer. And there is such a row going on, I absolutely can't hear myself think. Day and night, and all day and all night, guns and nothing but guns, and the shattering clang of bursting high explosives. This is the great offensive, the long-looked-for big push, and the whole course of the war will be settled in the next 10 days. Some time to be living in. It's quite funny to think that in London, life's going on just as usual, and no one even knows this show has started. While out here, at least 7 different kinds of hell are rampant.
Although there is a suggestion that the guns could be heard in London.
Bollocks. Those suggestions are rampant. Hang on.
Rampant suggestion. I'm not going there.
Let's move on.
The barrage continues without any sign of let up. And if anything, the British seem to bring more guns into action.
Boom, bang, a bang, boom, bang,
which increases the fire rate, concentrating on pouring
ever more shells to break down the German resistance.
Now, let's hear from Charles May again. Captain Charles May, 22nd Manchester Regiment. What does he say this time?
Up on the top, watching the bombardment over La Boisselle, Fricourt and Mametz, the speeding up has commenced. The hillsides over there are under a haze of smoke already. Shells, which bursting, throw up clouds, white puffs, black puffs, brown puffs and grey. Puffs which start as small downy balls and spread sideways and upwards till they dwarf the woods. Darts of flame and smoke, black smoke, these last which shoots high and into the air like a giant poplar tree. These are the HE, heavy explosives. The shooting was magnificent. Time and time again, the explosions occurred right in the Hun trenches. By Mametz Wood, an ammunition dump must have been struck. The resultant smoke column was enormous. Mametz itself one cannot see. It is shrouded in a multicoloured pall of smoke all of its own. It must be awfully rotten for the Huns holding the line, yet one feels no sympathy for them. Too long they have been able to strafe our devoted infantry like this and without hindrance or answer from us. What is sauce for the English goose is surely sauce for the German gander, and may his stomach relish it.
Oh, now, nobody's ever seen anything like this in the British Army, and it seems the Germans are doomed. It's not a surprise that commanders think that they're going to get through. This is Lieutenant William Bloor again, C Battery, 149th Brigade Royal Field Artillery.
It was a sight to see the hostile trenches. The whole countryside was just one mass of flame, smoke and earth thrown up sky high. About 5,000 shells per diem are pitching on a front of about 500 yards. Whilst observing, I could not resist feeling sorry for the wretched atoms of humanity crouching behind their ruined parapets and going through hell itself. Modern war is the most cruel thing I have heard of, and the awful ordeal of these poor devils, even though they are Boches, must be impossible to describe. Bosch.
Boches. I want to call them Boches.
They were Boches.
Boshy, Bosch, Bosch. Impossible to describe, indeed. Indeed, although he just describes it. Now, the moment's approaching for the attack. Every corps, every division, every brigade, they're all assigned their exact place in the battle line. They've all prepared their own plans tailored to the exact local situation. All this, more staff work, more. Is this staff work important?
Yeah, you've mentioned it on a number of occasions. You know, mistakes in staff work cost lives, Pete.
Yeah. So the orders are passed round, all around the infantry. Young officers, they're trying to assimilate all the massive detail they've got to learn. They've got to commit the layout of the ground, the layout of the German defences to memory. They've got to assess the probability or otherwise of success. Now, most of them are optimistic, aren't they? And why? We know why. Why? Gary? Why?
Well, they're looking at the masses of shells that are falling on the German lines, and they seem that there's every chance of a relatively painless success. Nothing could possibly survive that.
What could go wrong? Now, it's not funny, by the way, because we know this is the greatest tragedy about to unfurl. So I shouldn't be so light there. Now, the army commanders, they can't do much to impact on what's happening now. What would happen if they tried? Again, your experience with a gigantic corporation. What happens if you try and change your plan at the last minute?
Well, you can't, because the attack can't be cancelled. You can't change the plans now. Mistakes can't any longer be rectified without making the situation far worse. It's now down to the ordinary soldiers to go over the top, and they've got to overcome whatever lays before them.
And we feel very sorry for them for that. Now, Haig and his generals, they've fashioned their plans to the very best of their ability, and hamstrung by various things like the levels of training, all that, all that. But it's an enormous responsibility that you know, as they're lying hopefully alone in their beds at night, it must have borne down on them. But they choose to be optimistic. And this is, you're going to read a last quote from Haig now, General Sir Douglas Haig, GHQ.
The weather report is favourable for tomorrow. With God's help, I feel hopeful for tomorrow. The men are in splendid spirits.
Several have said that they have never before been so instructed and informed of the nature of the operation before them. The wire has never been so well cut, nor the artillery preparation so thorough. I have seen personally all the corps commanders, and one or all are full of confidence.
Now, this is the night before a tragedy, so we're not going to have our usual levity at the end. We all know what's going to happen, but I hope we've tried to explain why that we went into battle as we did, and the background to the 1st of July. The next episode we're going to do will be on the Somme, will be broadcast around about the 1st of July. It's a calamity, it's a disaster. Thanks for taking us through it, Gary.
Thank you, Pete, and I'm so sorry you struggled with your words today.
I've had a lot of problems.
Cheers, Pete. Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH, or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?